My name is Chris Mann. I'm with Captain, Naval Captain Colin H.P. Shaw, and we're at Dockyard in Esquimalt, B.C., and the date today is 27 June 1978, and we're in the, I guess this would be base commander's
hall? This is the base commander's residence, which was the oldest building in the dockyard, and it was built in 1879.
Absolutely lovely is what it is. I was wondering if you could start. I know your father had a tremendous career. I was wondering if you could give us a bit about your family background, military connection, and that type of thing.
Right. Well, I was born in England in April of 1925. My father was an officer in the Royal Navy. He was what is known as a supply officer. And a supply officer in the Royal Navy was concerned with not only logistics, but also with the secretariat.
What type of rank would supply officer be, sir?
Well, a branch that would go from midshipman right through to rear admiral. So I think when I was born, he was a lieutenant, brackets S for supply. And however, he really specialized in the secretariat side and devoted most of the time that I can recall in that field, as opposed to the straight logistics or supply function. I was born in Portsmouth, England, and maybe there was a connection there that sooner or later I was bound to end up in the Navy. I was, although I don't recall this, I know my family moved to Malta when I was about 8 months old, and we were 2 years in the Mediterranean, and in my early years lived in Portsmouth and Chatham and London, England. My schooling started in a small English private school in Bexhill-on-Sea, and then in 1935 I obtained a scholarship to the Westminster Abbey Choir School and was a choir boy in Westminster Abbey for 4 years. And I guess the high spot of that short career was singing at the coronation of King George VI.
That's incredible.
And from there I went on to a school called Portsmouth Grammar School, and that was 1939. And with the war starting, the policy then was to evacuate schools and school children from potentially target areas, and Portsmouth
right.
being one of them. So the school I was attending was evacuated to Winchester, but we were put into a rather old, beaten-up mansion with little or no furnishings, and after 3 months there, the school authorities, in their wisdom and very sensibly, I think, re-evacuated the school down to Bournemouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't really get started educating ourselves until about January of 1940. So
you had
lost a chunk of schooling.
Yeah. You didn't spend any time as a cadet in the...
Well, the school at the Portsmouth Grammar School, the British schools, or the equivalent of high schools, in fact, had a cadet corps known as the, OTC?
Mm-hmm.
I can't even recall what the title, anyhow, it was like army cadets in this country. And so we did a lot of really quite serious cadet training, because particularly when Dunkirk happened, the home guard was formed and so on, and there was no doubt that the cadets per se would have had to have done something if there had been an invasion. So the time at Winchester, while we were not educating ourselves in the formal sense, we did a lot of basic infantry field work and so on, and this was, we were all of, 14 or so
mm-hmm.
at the time.
You get much ship training though, at all.
But no, this was no naval input. This was a strictly army type.
It was an army type cadet.
Yeah. No interface with the Navy side at all. I wasn't in Sea Cadets. I was in Scouts and that sort of thing.
Yes.
but not sea cadets per se. So after that, my parents realized that losing that much education, and by this time I had, and probably largely influenced by the fact the war was on and she wanted to become involved, I had changed my sights from a field that I was thinking I might like to get into becoming interested in fact joining the Royal Navy. And I was too old by then to go to the cadet training establishment, Dartmouth. And the only other alternative was to enter under what they call the special entry scheme, which was known as the Frobisher entry. And to do that...
Was that a cruiser?
It was named after a cruiser, right. And to do that, you had to have really the equivalent of what we now would know as junior matric. And so my family realized that I was not likely to pass the entrance exams, having missed so much schooling. And so my father had a Royal Naval friend of his who had retired in Ottawa, and so he arranged that they would take me in to finish my education in Canada, where we wouldn't be interrupted with blackouts and air raids and all those sort of things.
So you actually did not join the Royal Navy, though you were anticipating the Royal Navy.
That's right. So I never joined the Royal Navy, and I came out here, but with the full intention, in fact, of sitting and writing the Frobisher entry exam. So I came out to Ottawa, went to Lisgar,
41?
This was 1940, and went to Lisgar Collegiate, which is high school in Ottawa. And in my second year there, I spotted a small ad in the Ottawa paper, which was announcing that the Royal Canadian Navy was going to open a naval college in Victoria, Royal Roads. And this was reopening a naval college, because the previous naval college had closed in 22. And so I thought, well, I'm here, I'll make application. So I applied, sat the entrance exam, appeared before the interview board, and was lucky enough to be accepted.
This is October
42. So this was October, well, in fact, we joined Royal Roads in the September. We didn't commission officially until Trafalgar Day of 1942. But in fact, we'd been in residence at Royal Roads since early in September. And the intake was 100 cadets, divided into a senior term of 50, and they were all people who in fact had completed Ontario grade 13 and had senior matric or equivalent, and 50 junior term who had finished Ontario grade 12 or with junior matric. And so I was in the junior term with a junior matric entry.
To finish grade 12?
Yeah, you had to finish grade 12.
Before you got into this?
Before you got
into... You're only 17 years old at this time.
Yeah.
Well, when did you start school? I'm trying to think.
Oh, in England. When did I start? Seven? Six?
No,
or seven.
I guess 17 is right. I was just thinking that. 17, 18, yeah. That's right. I wasn't thinking far.
Now, the plan there, of course, was in order to get a graduating class at the end of the first year.
Right.
They wanted a short course, and that's why they took half in with the senior matric. But every entry after my year and thereafter, of course, it was junior matric and a 2-year course and then graduation thereafter.
Chose the Royal Canadian Navy as opposed to the Royal Navy at this point because of availability and entrance?
I guess really probably it. It was here. I'd lived in the country 2 years and two very formative years.
Yes.
My contacts in England really now were literally down to my parents. And my sister had come out to Canada with me, my younger sister, so I had no real ties in England. There were no close friends who had joined the Royal Navy that I would want to join up with or be with. And and also, I guess I said, well, I like Canada as a country. I'd had 2 years living in the country, and I saw no real desire to go back. And so all these things, I guess, went through my mind, and I said, well, I'll try for the Canadian Navy as opposed to the IRN. Now, if I hadn't got into Royal Roads, I think I would have had a crack at the Royal Naval Entry exam.
The Frobisher thing.
Yeah. But as I say, got into Royal Roads, got into the RCN, and never got involved with the Royal Navy, other than, in fact, doing a lot of my early training with the Royal Navy.
I was wondering now then, your parents, this to be without parental consent or with parental consent, or how was this, they were in England at this point?
Yeah, there was parental consent in that, there had to be parental agreement to the Naval College, the Royal
right.
Roads for entry and so on. Oh yes, this wasn't sort of, the wayward son running off to sea or running off to the colonies to escape from England. Oh no, this was done, with full agreement. And of course, many years later, it was my father said it was probably one of the smartest things I ever did, because when he was a Royal Naval Captain and I was a Canadian Naval Lieutenant, I guess I was probably making about as much
money
as he was.
Yes, of course. You were accepted in Ottawa, is this correct? You passed your, you took your exam in Ottawa.
Yeah, the interview board, in fact, sat right across the country.
Country.
In the major centers. And
how did you make your way across?
Well, and having been accepted, you got the letter, you have been accepted to Royal Roads, et cetera, you are to report on a certain date, and then it was up to you to get yourself out here, so... I can remember, sort of getting on the train, and as we moved westward, other people, other guys would get on the train about your own age, and we suddenly found that we were all going to the same place. And so by the time the old CPR train pulled into Vancouver, there were probably about 20 of us, in fact, on the same train, and we, by this time, were starting to sort of mix up and get to know each other.
Did you have a... chaperone, I guess would be the proper term.
No, we didn't get met until we got off the CPR boat in Victoria. Because in those days, if I remember right, the train got in about 8 o'clock in the morning and it connected with the 10 o'clock day sailing of the Princess from Vancouver getting into Victoria about 1600. And then we were met by one of the chief petty officers from the college and loaded into the back of a 3-ton truck and taken off to the college.
What were your first impressions of the place? I mean, it's...
Pretty impressed. Royal Roads today, of course, there's the basic building, namely the castle or the Dunsmuir home. And then across from it and up the hill is what is known as the Grant Block.
Mm-hmm.
And on the left of the Grant Block is the Nixon Block. Well, when we joined, in fact, there was none of that at all. There was just the original Dunsmuir home. And so we all literally lived in that one building, and it was our mess for eating, it was our accommodation for sleeping, it was our place for studying. The actual classrooms were down to the west of the castle, about, quarter of a mile, I guess,
mm-hmm.
where the old... cow barns used to be, and that had been converted into classrooms. And then the next building beyond that, which was the old stables, had been converted into the engineering shops. And the only new building that had gone up was the gymnasium, which had in fact been built. Because for a year or a little bit more before it opened as an official Royal Canadian Naval College, it had been the training school for RCNVR
yes.
junior officers, and it was known in fact in those days as HMCS Royal Roads, and it was ran parallel with King's in Halifax for training
right.
RCNVR sub-lieutenants. So they built the gymnasium at that point in time, and that was all. Now the first year we were there, they in fact built what is now known as the Grant Block, which was the big concrete monster, because
mm-hmm.
we weren't very fussy about moving up to that modern concrete monster, having lived in the splendor of Hatley Park.
Yes. And you have what, rooms up top with the fireplaces?
Yeah, we had all the rooms in the upper levels.
Was the library up there at this point?
Yeah, the library was on the second deck on the mezzanine.
Yes.
And every sort of room above that was used for accommodation. And the cabins ranged in size from 4 to a cabin up to the biggest, I think, was roughly 20. The one I was in, there were 10 of us. And in good military style, it was all done alphabetically. So it was the S's to the end, at least R's to the end of the alphabet. And God, I think I probably still remember them. The first guy was Reynolds, who you now have seen, of course, that's Ted Reynolds on CBC.
CBC.
There was Reynolds, Rowley, Sabiston, Sanford, Smith, Shaw, Stairs, Wiggs, Whiteman, and Wood. And I'm
would
the last
Rowley
one
your,
left.
Rowley would be your brother-in-law now.
He was my brother-in-law, right. And
later to become brother-in-law.
Yeah, later to become brother-in-law, right. And I'm the last last serving officer of that group.
Ted Reynolds is on what, the sports news?
He's
on
the
CBC
sports announcer, or head of the department for CBC West.
CBC Sports.
Yeah. And my brother-in-law is retired. He was in the service for a while, and he's retired, and he's now in Ottawa, working in the Department of National Defense as a civilian. And Smith, Bud Smith, he retired as a naval commander, and he's now in Victoria, and a member of the school board, in fact. That's RNG, or Bud Smith. And Wiggs is in Ottawa. Whiteman is in Ottawa. Both civil servants. Woods disappeared completely off the face of the earth. We never really found out where he went to after about 1948, 1949. He didn't go regular force. We had an option. On graduation, you could go regular force, you know, RCM permanent, or reserve.
What do you mean?
And of my particular class, we worked out at 30 roughly went regular permanent force, and about 20 went reserve, right from
that,
the beginning.
That many wanted reserve?
Yeah.
Now, would you say your colleagues then were trying to get their education?
Education, do their sort of wartime
fencing
thing, but at the same time saying, but this is not really what I want to do for the rest of my life. And
well, how did you feel about them at the time? Or
didn't
no
not
or?
not a bit, no. In fact, in some ways, we were almost a little bit envious of them, I think, because quite a large number of them went off to sea, but in the smaller ships. And of course, the smaller the ship, the more responsibility you got, and the quicker you got the responsibility. And a number of them, for instance, went off to MTBs, motor torpedo boats.
Yes.
And a motor torpedo boat would have a crew of a captain, a first officer, and a second hand sort of thing, you know. And so right there, as a midshipman, the guy was,
second officer,
you know. And whereas you went off to sea as a regular sort of permanent force midshipman, and you were just a midshipman in a cruiser, you know, and you were just
between a rock and a hard place.
So, but there was not one. I never ever heard anybody say, "Oh, there's old so and so. He's going to go reserve," you know. And but let's face it, you lived for 2 years with 50 guys, and you know, you really build up a very close group spirit.
With Captain Grant, that's the fellow's name, was he mm-hmm. the base or the commandant at Royal Roads at
this
point?
He was the captain of the college, John Grant, Captain John Grant.
He's still alive, by the way.
Oh, yes. in fact, he was the recipient of the first honorary degree that Royal Roads granted last year. Oh, yeah, John Grant, he was a super guy. Very, very, not stern disciplinary, but you know, the rules were the rules, and that was it.
Well, he came through in 1911 with one of the first naval college,
mm-hmm.
RCN
mm-hmm.
naval
yep.
training, whatever you want to call it,
those right.
days.
In fact, if you know, going back in history, and it's, I guess it's a small world, but my father and he were midshipmen together back in 1913.
You're kidding.
Yeah. And a funny story out of that, in fact, is that because I was in the Westminster Abbey Choir, because I got a coronation medal in 1937. Well, when you're living with a group of guys, you know, you don't really sort of like to sort of blossom forth with all sorts of extra finery. See, so I didn't didn't put the thing up at all. And I guess, unbeknownst to me, I guess Captain Grant and my father had been sort of in some sort of
communication.
And I guess my father made some comment about it. You know, I hope my young son is sort of properly dressed and wearing his ribbon or something. Anyhow, I was sent for and told that I was improperly dressed, which won me, I think it was one day's number 11, which was a punishment, and told to get my ribbon up.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So you had your you had to wear your coronation ribbon as a
cadet.
As a cadet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's incredible. What was number 11, by the way?
Number 11 was, you had to get up half an hour before the rest of the world, which was, so you had to be up out of your rack at 6 o'clock, and you did sort of half an hour's either doubling around outside or some extra work. And then at the end of the day, you got 1 hour's extra drill on the parade square with a rifle, sort of marching or doubling, mostly doubling, and then 1 hour's extra work, which could be anything. And you may have seen over the entrance into Grant Block, there's a quotation from Nelson.
Nelson, yes.
You know, business is the duty of a sea officer, and all other considerations must give way to it, no matter how painful it be or something.
Right.
And it's on a lovely mahogany board, and they're brass letters raised on the board. Well, all those letters were filed by hand in the engineering shops by us guys doing our number 11.
Oh my God.
So I have a couple of letters up there which I feel very close to.
That's great.
But it was...
Well, get back now to the training now. You got off at the back of this truck.
Mm-hmm.
You're taken into probably one of the most palatial places in Victoria,
mm-hmm.
or in the Vancouver Island area. It's the Royal Military College. Is it the Royal Military College at this point?
No. It was the Royal Canadian Naval College, RCNC. And it was Royal Canadian Naval College, but like all naval establishments, it also had to, it was a commissioned ship, so it also had an HMCS
yes.
name, so it was HMCS Royal Road.
Right. Now, did you have the bell and all that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. The bell was there, and the big mast was the halyards. And the thing was completely navalized, right down to the sort of the tiddly ropes and the stanchions, and, everything was done at the double. And, you didn't live in a room. You lived in cabins. Your recreation or lounge area was known as the gun room. There was a senior gun room and the junior gun room, and where you dined was the mess.
Mm-hmm.
And it was completely navalized. And of course, down in the on the lagoon was the boathouse with whalers and cutters and dinghies for sailing.
Right.
And pulling.
pulling.
Yes. Yes. We even used to lug them over the Esquimalt Spit and launch them forth into the wide open ocean from time to time, pull them over by hand, using the driftwood logs as rollers.
This in lieu of the route march, or just...
No, this was just, just for sailing, just seamanship, yeah. But it let you get out into the open water, where, of course, you had better breeze, and better wind. And we'd do fleet maneuvers with six or eight whalers, and you'd have two divisions, and the cutter would be the flagship of each division, and we'd do turns and in those days there were red turns and blue turns, and we hadn't run into some funny American words like corking. That was a new one to us. We had wheels and do it all under sail. The seamanship instructor was a Lieutenant Mason, Cock Mason, a tremendous man. Started life as a boy seaman with the Royal Navy and then came out to the Canadian Navy probably in the late 20s or early 30s, and by this time he'd risen to the rank of, he'd gone through warrant officer, commissioned warrant officer, and he was now a lieutenant. And he was a seamanship instructor. And he still had his sort of Cockney accent and his Cockney witticism. But he was a superb, in fact, really, that the whole college, when you look back on it, they had some superb instructors, both officers and senior chiefs and petty officers. Chief Petty Officer Sweet, the senior PTI, for instance, he left us at the end of the first year, went to Athabasca, and was lost when she was sunk, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
He was the coxswain of Athabasca. Chief Petty Officer Briggs was the GI, and he's still around town. Chief Yeoman Smith was the Chief Yeoman of Signals, taught us flashing and semaphore with great difficulty. And And then the executive officers, we had a number. There was Phil Haddon, lieutenant commander in those days. Phil Haddon was the first XO, and then he left, and we had a chap called Jumbo Weber arrived, which rather shattered everybody. When he arrived at your cabin door at 6 o'clock in the morning in his sea boots and white turtleneck sweater, submarine sweater. And then the XO that lasted the longest was a man called G. Huntley Davidson, who was retired on the island, retired as a commander. But they were all a very fine group. There's a Professor C.C. Cook, who is still in town. He was the director of studies until about 10 years ago. There, he was our physics instructor for mm-hmm.
him. Well, what was your first, not impression, I think we got that, but were you taught to line up or dress off, or what was the first order of business?
Well, I guess, the first thing, of course, you had to get measured for uniform. So we spent the first probably 2 weeks in, the clothes you arrived with,
civilian
clothes, but it was very easy to issue a white shirt. And in those days, of course, it was a separate collar.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a white shirt and a stiff collar with rounded corners, not pointed corners, and a black tie and black socks and boots. So you wore your civilian attire, but with a black tie and a white shirt and black boots.
So they were starting off the beginning with a uniform of sorts.
That's right. So we were all like that. You immediately got into the rudiments of forming up as a form body, marching, at least, as I say, you never marched, you doubled, but you always doubled, fallen in threes, and you moved as a group with somebody in charge. In the early days, until they had selected from the senior term cadet officers, or cadet captains, as they were known as, somebody would be detailed off each day to take charge of a division, and then he would fall you in and turn you to the right and double off down to the classrooms or double off to the gym or whatever it was. So I suppose probably the first 3 or 4 days it was drill and issuing of kit and books, because the academic program was a mixture of, academics, math, English, history, French, mechanics, chemistry, physics. I guess that was probably the academic syllabus. And then on top of that, the naval subjects of navigation, gunnery, torpedo, communications, and seamanship. So you're running about a 10-subject program.
How strenuous were these subjects?
Well, I would say that they would equate to the equivalent of Victoria College at that point in time, a good solid Ontario grade 13
first year
university, and in fact the current standing now in as far as my sort of personal records show is that I've completed the equivalent of 2 years university from that age. It was a very good education. The academic staff, the professors were all, they weren't just naval officers. I mean, they were
full bona fide
professors. The three senior ones, in fact, had come to the college from RMC in Kingston, because it closed the year we opened.
Right.
The director of studies was a man called KGB Ketchum.
Ketchum?
Yeah.
I've heard that name before.
Who was enrolled into the Navy as a commander. And he had been the either the principal or the vice principal of St. Andrew's School, which is a big private school north of Toronto. So, that particular group were well, properly qualified academics. The naval side was taught by lieutenants primarily, each in their own specialty: gunnery officer, a torpedo officer, an electrical officer. Well, no, torpedo officer taught electrics as well. Jack Mason, that I mentioned, taught seamanship as a lieutenant. Communications was taught by the chief yeoman. Drill was taught by the gunnery instructor. navigation was taught by, in fact, two people. One was a then Lieutenant Commander Ogle, who taught astro navigation, and a Lieutenant Genge, who taught pilotage. And, half of them were permanent force, or permanent Navy, and the other half were reserve, volunteer reserve people. Am I talking loud enough for the for the thing? I don't know whether
it's wiggling
or not.
We'll take a break and we'll find out right now.
Yeah.
We're back. While at Rhodes at this point, you were fitted up with your uniform,
mm-hmm.
which would be what?
Okay, it was a Serge Navy blue number 5 uniform. Where instead of it had no stripes on the arm, it had the cadet's button and twist on the lapel. We also got issued a pair of gray flannels and a blazer, which for more casual wear. And I'm trying to think what we used to wear every day to go to classes. I guess we just wore, straight number 5s, collar and tie, jacket, and the whole business. And, a standard naval
mm-hmm.
cap, black in the winter and a white cap cover
yeah.
in the summer.
No stripes or
bars no stripes
or anything?
Because you...
Was there not a flash on the cap at all?
Well, it was naval cap badge. But, it was a standard junior officer's cap.
Mm-hmm.
The only differentiation was that the cadet captain wore a symbol on his arm, which it's pretty hard to describe. It's sort of with a stripe that rose sort of on an angle of about 45 degrees, had a diamond form at the top, and then fell back on a 45 degrees. So it's sort of an inverted V with a diamond on the top. And that was the identifying mark of a cadet captain. But the rank of cadet was symbolized by the twist on the lapel and the button. And when you became a midshipman, of course, that twist was then superimposed on a white
patch.
And the volunteer reserve, the twist was superimposed on a purple patch.
Right.
Different color.
What about food?
What about food?
Is it memorable?
The only memorable thing about the food, I guess, is I can still remember the first meal, having arrived off the ferry across from Vancouver, and all sort of marching into supper the first night, and it was sausages and mash. And I guess it's the sort of thing you always remember. They were certainly not the most memorable sausages or bangers that I'd ever eaten, but by that time you get pretty hungry anyhow, and I think we'd have eaten anything. The food was good. It was it wasn't fancy, but I mean it was good, wholesome food, and there was always plenty of it, and I don't think anybody really howled about food. We burned up a hell of a lot of energy because it was a very active life, in that you started your day at 6:30. you alternated. One day was PT, so you got called at 6:30. And you had to fall in outside and double off to the gym at 6:35. So you had 5 minutes to get out of your bed and get into your PT rig and go. The next morning you would have 30 minutes in which to get up and shave and wash and get your bunk made up and so on. And then you fell in and you did practical signaling, either flashing light or semaphore. So you
rushed down. You didn't rush down to the mast every morning. For ensign going up.
No, well, that, you see, that the colors weren't until 8 o'clock anyhow.
I see, okay.
So this was all before breakfast. So you'd have half an hour PT.
It was all before colors.
So you had half an hour PT or half an hour flashing, because by the time you got out of the block to do the flashing or the communications, the PT class and I would be coming back to shower and shave and make up their bunks. So the whole thing would then come to a sort of together for everybody going into breakfast at I guess it'd be about 7:30, 7:45, and then the first classes would start at 8:15 or 8:30. So we didn't become involved in colors per se,
mm-hmm.
But I We normally became involved in evening quarters, but then again that wasn't sunset, because sunset, of course, is a varying time throughout the year. But we'd fall in at the end of the day for evening quarters. And then, so that would be at 1600, and there'd be sort of half an hour then where you had a cup of tea and a bun. And then we'd all go off and have compulsory sports, you know, soccer or rugger or cross-country running or something, which would carry you through from sort of 1630 until about 1730, quarter to six. And then the evening meal, I think, was at 6 or 6.30. And then it was compulsory study from 1900 to 2100, and at 2130 it was lights out, everybody's in bed, gone, you know.
That was the day.
This
7 day a week type thing.
No, Monday to Friday, and then Saturday mornings we worked. So we had classes Saturday morning. Saturday afternoon was free time, but mostly sports. And then Sunday was a free day.
Were you allowed out of the airport?
Leave was.
We're talking leave now. We're not talking just leaving for the day or the.
No.
Break, no. Leave.
Yeah, there was no leave during the week. On Sunday, you could go ashore from 1 o'clock until 9 o'clock, three Sundays a month. And at 9 o'clock, leave expired at 9:30. And at 9 o'clock, a three-ton truck left the Hudson's Bay Company to take you back to the college. You were allowed one Saturday a month in your junior term with leave until 9. And in the senior term, you were allowed two Saturdays a month, one with a leave expiring at 2100, and the other one expired at midnight. And that was a great occasion. Things like taxes, of course, were out of the question, because we got the enormous sum of 75 cents a week in your first year and a dollar a week in your second year. So unless you had a private income, you really weren't terribly rich. So you probably couldn't afford to go ashore all that much anyhow.
As a midshipman, you make 25 cents a day.
Midshipman, we made $2 a day. Very rich.
Well, that's right. You went up to $2 a day.
$2 a day, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that was very good. Thought I was a millionaire.
Millionaire.
Yeah.
The cadet used to be 25 cents a day.
Yeah, cadets were 25 cents a day, but that was pre-Royal Road. This was when the cadets were taking their training over in England with the Royal Navy. And this was always, this has always been one of the bones of contention, because I think I'm right in saying that the cadets who went over to the Royal Navy for training were in fact full members of the RCN, and so that time counted for pension. But when we were at Royal Road, there was an act passed through Parliament which sort of established the college and the basic ground rules, and it was not deemed to be full paid service. In fact, it was not unpaid service, in that the 75 cents a week or a dollar a week that was paid out to us in fact came from the fees that the college established, which was $250 a year. School fees. Paid by your parents. Therefore, they maintained under the Act, anyhow, that it was non-paid service. And we have tried many times to have that time count for pension, even if we paid back for pension purposes. But we never managed to win the battle, because we were never a large enough group, I think, to really make a big noise.
Yeah, but your uniforms were provided, whereas the other fellows had to, parents also had to provide uniforms and things to the Royal.
Well, no, they maintained the uniforms. Came out of that $250 a month, or $250 a year, rather.
Yeah.
The $250 a year fee paid for your uniform and your financial allowance.
I see.
Food, lodging, and education was provided by the service.
Interesting.
Now, we maintained that, you know, that in fact we were being paid in kind, i.e., food, lodging, and education. So that was the equivalency of pay.
Right.
And we also maintained that we were under the, well, we were told certainly by by the college authorities, you know, that we were under the Naval Discipline Act. And therefore, if we committed a crime, we were punished and received the punishment as laid down by regulations for the RCN. Therefore, we were under the Naval Discipline Act. So in our argument to try and get this time to count for pension, we said we were paid in kind, we were under the Naval Service Discipline Act, therefore it should be pensionable time. But we never won.
That's great. Well, what were civilian military relations at this point? We're in wartime. And I guess I got two questions to ask. And what was the attitude of the fellows in the college? Were they eager to get out? Eager to get overseas with the winter courses?
I think that it really came to mind most vividly, of course, at the end of the first year when our senior term graduated and went off to the fleet.
Mm-hmm.
And we were left behind. So they were off to do their thing and we still had another year to go. Naturally, I think, as a bunch of young guys, you knew it was going on and you wanted to become involved and you didn't really want to stay cooped up back there with another year of education to go.
She must have felt in isolation in that Halifax, I guess, was the hub of Navy activities. And
there wasn't the same tempo, I don't think, going on the West Coast. But on the other hand, remember, we were really tucked away out there for, pretty much, other than the month's leave in the summer and 2 weeks at Christmas. You were tucked away at Royal Roads, and very seldom did we have any contact with Naden, the base as we know it today. Other than coming into the swimming pool for sort of swimming instruction. We formed a guard of honor for the launching of the frigate, the Waskasu, which was launched by then Princess Juliana from Yarrows. So that was sort of an interface.
Mm-hmm.
But really very little contact with the real Navy that was going on downtown. Would you excuse me one second? I've got it. So, let's say really not that much interface with the Navy. Now, during the course...
Populous.
Well, touching on the Navy. Now, during the course of the years there, we got a couple of crews, the odd crews for sea experience. The Miramichi was... Bangor class minesweeper, and so we went out in Miramichi for 3 or 4 days up in the Gulf Islands and so on. We did a 10-day cruise, I guess about 10 days, eight, 10 days cruise in a converted yacht called the Pfeiffer. Then there was another converted, when I say yacht, I mean a millionaire's sort of 150-footer, none of this sort of small sailing yacht.
Mm.
Then there was a big fellow, which was American-owned, called a Sans Purr, that we used for the odd cruise. So that gave you, a little bit of interface with the Navy, per se.
You can get out on the... Was it the seat belt still here?
No. I don't think so. I don't know whether she was even running. But we didn't see very much. We didn't really come into the dockyard, hardly at all, maybe for a familial visit. We had very little contact with Naden as it was then.
Well, you saw the ships coming in from Barrow.
But you see the ships coming in there at harbour, yes, but that would be about all. But our whole life was centred at Royal Roads. And running a sort of a 6:30 until 9:30 non-stop day, you really didn't have all that much time to sit around and look seaward, and watch the world go by. And when leave came, most of the guys would head off, if it was in reach and they could afford it, head off to various, their homes across the country. The civilian side, really it was, most of us got involved with one or two families in town. And again, with that very limited leave allowance anyhow, I think most of us would sort of... go off and maybe have a meal with a family that was sort of had taken us and we got to know through one means or another. And then I think probably just about everybody had sort of managed somehow along the way to find and acquire a girlfriend, and so you'd take her to a show or a dance or something. You know, but again, it was like Cinderella, you know, the witching hour, 12, 9 o'clock,
nine
and you
o'clock
say,
at the
goodbye,
house of the day,
you go,
yeah.
You know.
Wait for the truck.
Yeah.
This, I gather, is where you met the Rowley family.
That's right, yeah. Because, you see, her, my wife's brother, mm-hmm. and I were cadets together. And not having a family in Canada, and it was really asking a lot for the people who'd taken me into their home in Ottawa, sort of pay my railway fare and so on. So the first Christmas leave, my brother, now brother-in-law, they were living in Vancouver because his father was in the RCN permanent force and he'd been posted or transferred to Jericho Beach, and they were living in Vancouver. So they very kindly said, you know, bring a cadet home for Christmas who had nowhere to go to. Well, he and I had been at the same high school in Ottawa, so we knew each other slightly. So he said, well, look, you know, you've got nowhere to go. Come home to my place for Christmas. And then the following spring, they moved across to Victoria. So that really became my sort of home. And so when I had leave, I sort of would go there and get fed
mm-hmm.
and have somewhere to sit and put my feet up and talk to a family, you know, and have a home life. But, you know, it would be hard to answer sort of, you know, what were the civilians in Victoria thinking about the war and,
mm-hmm.
You know, within that particular household, because he was a serving officer, there obviously there,
role,
was,
yeah.
There was knowledge of it and so on. I don't think I can recall it. I'm sure we did, but I don't think we sort of made a point of sitting around the kitchen table and saying, you know, how's the war going this week and what have you.
Well, what was your...
But we would follow it at Rhodes, of course, you know, and just reading the newspaper and so on.
Well, what did you think of the NRMA at this point? The zombies, as they were called?
I don't think we were really aware of them. I think that was all going back in the East. I don't really recall sort of thinking about the conscription issue, and which came to a head when, 1940...
Started in 39, actually.
No, but I mean, it came to a crunchy 44. Crunch about 43, 44.
Well, there was two versions, 42 and 44.
Yeah. I don't recall, you know, having great discussions in the gunroom. There probably were some, but not enough to sort of register and remember back to, you know, horrendous discussions and arguments about the pros and cons of the rights and the wrongs of conscription and whether it should,
mm-hmm.
if there was conscription, do you conscript for service in Canada only or
mm-hmm.
overseas service and what have you.
What about Mackenzie King? What was the talk in the gun room about him? Or was he commander and okay at this point? Or was he looked on?
We were a pretty non-political bunch.
You were just busy getting your education.
We were busy doing our cadet thing, you know.
That's fair enough, sir. Did you have any specific goals or ambitions at this point about a future career? Now, you did not choose the RC, what is it, the RCNVR? You chose the Royal Canadian
yep.
Navy. Pull up.
No,
there was no doubt in your mind.
There was no doubt in my mind by this time that I wanted to be a naval officer, and I think, you know, naturally, I think all of us, if you're thinking at all, I mean, you're aspiring to achieving at least a reasonably senior rank. I suppose at that stage in life, the greatest goal was to have command of your own ship, and it didn't really matter whether it was a rowboat or a battleship. But being a line officer as opposed to an engineer officer or a supply officer or electrical officer or, you know, one of the technical side, but being a straight, you know, line officer, that I think at that time I could say was probably my greatest goal. You know, I didn't worry about the rank, whether I reached the ranks of lieutenant commander or captain or admiral or what,
mm-hmm.
but I sure did want to be in command of my own ship, at whatever rank it came to pass.
Whatever
yeah.
it was.
Yeah.
You finished your training in August 1944.
Mm-hmm.
This is just after D-Day.
Yeah.
You
mm-hmm.
Did you feel sort of...
Left out.
Left
yes.
out?
Yeah. Oh, hell, we missed it. I think it was the sort of general feeling of the 50 cadets who were graduating. You know, we missed it. And those lucky guys in the senior term got there in time to be
mm-hmm.
involved. Now, not that they all were, because they were serving at sea and they're not necessarily
mm-hmm.
in the Channel area. But the thing was that we just missed it, you know, by a couple of months.
Crestfallen or?
Yeah, disappointed. We'd missed the big thing.
a big show.
Yeah.